saying his warrant price rises could hit 11% later this year, but will come down in the year after. Experts say the UK could be at risk of recession.
The Bank of England's got it wrong as usual. So it will come down, but it will be much more persistent than anybody is anticipating. And to get it back down to 2% could take at least 3 years, not two, not one. And it's going to take a long time, actually, because it's now embedded in the system. And people will want to catch up. You see, the public sector, they're going to take a big real wage cut this year, probably, but they're not going to tolerate that the following year.
The government says one way to contain inflation is to suppress wages. Prices are going up, but incomes are not keeping up. That has meant sweeping rail strikes over demands for higher pay. Some public sector workers, such as teachers and medics, have received a pay rise, but below the inflation rate.
These are tough times for everybody, but it's those on the lowest incomes who are feeling the pinch. According to one study, more than 4 million, that's one in six British households, are worse off now than they were last year, a number that could change come the cold season. Saeed Puriza, London.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri of life in jail over participating in killing imprisoned dissidents. Nouri is a former judiciary staff who has been convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, while he served as an assistant to the deputy prosecutor at the Gohardash prison outside the Iranian city of Karaj. Protesters here warn that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nouri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nouri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nouri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nouri by members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nouri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nouri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's flagship carrier, Iranair, has returned to Rome from July 14. A new deal recently signed between Iranian and Italian aviation authorities has revived the route connecting Tehran and Italy's capital, Rome. The deal is a revised version of previous aviation cooperation agreement, which stresses the importance of increased flights between the two countries to help boost economic ties and tourism.
I visited Iran 20 years ago, and I've been thrilled about that trip. I'm going again with a group of friends in September, and we're all very excited.
There has certainly been a more intense dialogue between Italy and Iran lately, and this is extremely positive. Having said that, we are still facing enormous difficulties due to the sanctions. However, we are confident that more European routes will be added by Iran Air in the future.
Iranair, which has been flying to Italy for 55 years, also operates flights to the business-focused city of Milan in the north of the country. Aviation ties between Iran and Italy took a hit in 2018 when the US unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Washington's withdrawal was followed by a wave of anti-Iran sanctions by the US.
I hope this resumption of the Tehran-Rome route will bode well for another resumption, that of the JCPOA, from which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018. It would be really important for tourism and commerce that flight connections between Iranian and European cities are established.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Rome last week to meet his Italian counterpart and discuss the latest geopolitical developments across the globe. During that visit, Iran's top diplomat also met with tens of Italian industrialists and businessmen who showed a strong interest in cooperating with Tehran. Max Civili, Rome.
As temperatures in Britain soar, the race for the next Conservative Party leader is also heating up. Following further eliminations, now only three candidates remain. On Monday, Tom Tugendhat was eliminated during the third round vote, whilst Kemi Badenoch went out in the fourth. Rishi Sunak remains in the lead. Penny Mordaunt is close in second place, followed by Liz Truss. However, as the fight intensifies, things are turning bitter, with attacks on policy, along with accusations of ideological treachery, leading to candidates refusing to appear on future televised debates. Pundits believe the divisive race has exposed deep-rooted splits in the ruling party at a time when Britain faces numerous economic crises.
A senior Conservative journalist said to me that he found the entire leadership campaign wholly depressing. He thinks that it's been a competition to be negative. He thinks it's a race to the bottom in terms of showing what's wrong with the others rather than what's right with themselves. And crucially, we see a party divided. It seems to me that the Conservatives are going through an identity crisis, perhaps partly caused by Boris Johnson, who is a populist, without a very clear philosophy. Now, the next leader has to refocus the Conservatives on its more traditional values.
There can be little doubt in Rishi Sunak achieving a place in the final round, as he only requires five more supporters in order to achieve that place. However, the real battle will be over who joins him in second place. Two candidates will last into the final round, and then, of course, it goes to the votes from the Tory party membership to decide who the next leader of the party, and therefore the country, will be. Robert Carter, London.
During a joint press conference, which followed the latest round of their Astana process talks, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi welcomed the Russian and Turkish presidents, along with their accompanying delegations, to the summit. Raisi stressed the need to protect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, as well as the importance of the fight against terrorism.
Discussions focused on the sovereignty of Syria and the territorial integrity of the country, emphasizing that the Syrian government must rule over all parts of the country and that the presence of Americans on the eastern banks of the Euphrates is not acceptable and they must withdraw and all parts of the country must be governed by the legitimate government. We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism and there is the need to do so and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region. The all-out fight against terrorism by the Islamic Republic of Iran was a successful experience. I commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani as the icon of resistance and combating terrorism. All countries have fought against terrorism, but today there are concerns about the presence of terrorists in Syria. So there is a need for firm results to be achieved by all states that participate in the fight against terrorism.
Russian President Vladimir Putin echoed similar remarks and highlighted the importance of the Astana process.
We agree. In order to normalize the situation in Syria, all three countries have agreed that full settlement of the conflict is only possible through political means and holding talks based on UNSC Resolution 2254, and while observing the basic principle of sovereignty and territorial integrity and unity of Syria. All these principles must be respected, and the future of Syria must be dictated by its own people, and nothing should be dictated from the outside.
Putin added that all sides have called for the continuation of the fight against terrorism and extremism so that such threats will be eliminated. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while echoing the remarks made by his counterparts, also pointed out the importance of finding a sustainable political solution to the Syrian situation.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Prime Minister Mario Draghi has tendered his resignation, which will pave the way for snap elections. It is reported that fractious parties torpedoed his national unity government, and that could bring the hard right to power. Why wouldn't the coalition parties, for the sake of the country, try to smooth things out and solve their problems, especially during a time when Italy, like many European countries, is experiencing economic challenges? This edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what kind of future will be awaiting for Italy. Our guests for this edition of The Spotlight are the Secretary General of the City Foundation, Paolo Raffone, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will first start with you, if I may, Paolo Raffone. And we're looking, obviously, at a political crisis there in Italy. And the way that the crisis was sparked, based on the reports that we got, was some disagreements that were on the economic approach, let's say, by Mario Draghi, which the five-star was said to have snubbed a key vote last week on that. How do you see things at this point in the way that they have unfolded?
Well,
It's clear the government headed by Draghi is over and elections will come. Elections which have been awaited for quite a time, and the situation in the country was stable, but there were no improvements in terms of living standards under the Draghi's government. So the crisis that has been sparked also by the war in Ukraine, the increase in the prices, the inflation, have complicated a lot the conditions of many sectors of the Italian society. And certain parties have been demanding a change in the approach to Draghi, who didn't want to do it. So he ignored basically the requests. And this has then precipitated into a non-vote, which was not a non-confidence vote, but was a non-vote of one of the members of the coalition supporting the government. Then after this, the reaction by Draghi has been yet more stiffy, and this has caused other parties to join the non-vote procedure. Therefore, there was no more political majority for him.
Well, Mahmoud Rafat, what do you think about these three parties that were in coalition, basically looking at the Salvini's Anti-Immigrant League, the Populist Five Star Movement, and then you have, obviously, the center-right Forza Italia. Does the combination of them along with Draghi too overwhelming for example, reforms to take place and leading to what we're looking at right now?
Well, the withdrawal was somehow expected of these three political parties. But let me tell you, the most critical part of these three parties is the five-star movement, because as we know, it's a populist movement, and the populism somehow is invading Europe on several levels now, backed by the immigration topic, also the economic crisis, and recently the situation with Russia, which is also impacting the European economy heavily. And as we have been seeing last few weeks, the euro went down for the first time in front of the US dollar to be less than one US dollar. This is not only the immigration, not only the economic situation, this is a result of the group, of the bunch of elements which made a big and high pressure on the European economy. And when there is serious economic problems, always populist movements can increase and can rise and can find acceptance on the ground. And this is the most critical thing we will face, not only in Italy, because we must also understand both Italy and France are somehow a guide of Europe politically. The eyes of rest of Europe watch these two Latin countries very carefully, and the populations of northern people, southern people of Europe get impacted by the movement of and the political movement in these two Latin countries, because they are ancient countries and they have very big soft power on the rest of Europe. So the most, again, I would repeat that the most critical withdrawal and the most critical issue we are facing today is the five stars movement behavior, as it is, will impact other European countries. Italy, in particular, has lots of political problems since a few years, especially because of the economic situation and also somehow the problem of the immigration. But still, again, if the movement, the five-star movement, doesn't take a rational way, that will make these problems heavier and stronger.
Well, Paolo Raffone, if you think about it, you couldn't have a better person in that position with the resume that Mario Draghi has. I mean, honestly, when you take a look at it, the governor of the Bank of Italy, the chairman of the Financial Stability Forum, and, of course, he was heading the worst, probably one of the worst financial crises, the financial crisis of 2008, where that he was involved in. So why did things not go as smoothly as his resume dictates, in a sense?
From a technical point of view, he is a very respectable person, as we all know. And in technical terms, he has been leading the government correctly. The problem is that he's not a politician. He doesn't have a political feeling. He doesn't have a social feeling. He is a technician. And life is not only made of technical issues. It's made also of sentiments. And his attitude has not facilitated at all the swallowing by the political parties of his policies. And he has demonstrated his limits in handling a political and social situation, which for at least the past 2 months has been signaling that something was not going in the desired direction.
Well, if you take a look at the way that the supporters are expressing themselves, Mahmoud Rafat, obviously they're not too happy about this, obviously. But they're saying, and this warning is my question to you, that they're viewing this as a government collapse. And they're saying and warning that this is going to worsen the social ills when you have such bad economic indicators, for example, like inflation or a delay in the budget. Of course, you're also looking at the way that the Ukraine conflict has affected not just Italy, but many European economies. So why couldn't these parties set aside the differences, as Draghi said, and work things out?
Sorry, would you repeat the question again? The line.
Why couldn't they set aside their differences at this very, very sensitive time and work things out instead of having Italy be dragged out or dragged down with the economic challenges that the country is facing?
Well, I think, let me agree with my colleague Paolo here. Mr. Draghi is a very excellent person as economist. Mr. Draghi is a very theocratic person and professional in his domain as economist. He used to be president of Central Bank of Europe, and he is very successful, but he is not a politician. Political world is completely different than the economic life and the economic world. The also meantime, he has very tendency to the socialism and the social approach for the society, which is not really to enable a politician to succeed, to handle and to manage a government under him, and number of ministers coming from different backgrounds and number of political parties, and each political party has its own interest. So the issue is in the non-experience, non-political experience of Mr. Draghi himself. This is the main point. Yes, he has very excellent and very high profile as economist, but not as politician. And this is the point here. Let's say Italy is not an easy country. It has a long history with with elections, with democratic games, with political games. It has a very, very, very long history. It's a Latin country. So it's not that easy to manage this number of political parties if you do not have enough experience and if you are not well-trained to do that. Mr. Draghi was not well-trained to do that. He was wonderful in his position in the European Central Bank. He was wonderful as economist, but as politician, he did not. He could not really manage and handle the whole elements of Italy.
Okay. Well, let's see here. If we want to take a look at how somebody who should be acquainted with politics to have that facet be on his resume, which obviously the post of a prime minister should do that or should have that. The alternative here is, hold on, let me make sure I get this party straight. The Brothers of Italy party. Is that what we're looking at here? Paolo Raffone, neo-fascist roots, leading in the polls with 23.9%. If I had a choice between the Brothers of Italy party and Mario Draghi, hands down, I think people would go for Mario Draghi. But tell us what you think, if this is who's the party that's leading in the polls.
Well, first of all, to label it neo-fascist is completely wrong, because it is a party of right, for sure, conservative, But the transformation from its long past happened about 35 or 40 years ago, and it has nothing to do anymore with the roots of the fascism. So this is something to be understood. It is a right-wing conservative party, that's for sure. The population in Italy is scared, but it's scared by everything, is scared by the situation, and therefore they look for some security somewhere. And I would say that easily you will have a split at almost 50% of people who would think that a more determined, conservative, right-wing ruling gives them this opportunity, as well as another 50% would prefer the status quo, and if sort of Draghi program without Draghi will be presented, they will vote for that. And this is the gamble that is in this election now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then I stand corrected in terms of what you described very well for us, the roots being there, but that was before, and now obviously they don't have that description, fit that description of neo-fascist. Now, what are we looking at, Mahmoud Rafat, when we're taking a look at what the country is going to be headed down to in terms of the snap election? Are we looking at a period of uncertainty, which really there's no time to waste given the economic landscape of Europe? And, of course, Italy is not obviously immune to what's this really nightmare scenario, economically speaking.
Well, which I expect Italy will suffer and will seriously suffer economically next few months. Especially the European Union now will not be able to present more aid packages under the financial situation and the economic situation of the European Union itself now. Let's remember that the main aid or the biggest part of aid for the European Union comes from the biggest two economies in Europe, which are Germany and France. And both of them are, Germany and France, I mean, have a serious problem with the gas for the moment, especially the winter is not very far from us. The winter will start in Europe within 2 months and a half, 3 months maximum. We will start, especially in the north of Europe, to suffer of the lacking of the gas. There will be gas lacking and shortage on the gas because of the Russian-Ukrainian war. And that will impact a lot the European economies, especially the French and the German. And so I expect the real problem will come in Italy, that the European Union will not give its back to Italy because it never made, and the European Union was always there to help any European state which has such problem. But this time, the European Union will not be able, in my estimation, to help as should be. That's why there will be big inflation, there will be unemployment will increase, there will be lots of economic problems in the country, and these problems, how deep they will go, it will depend on the depth, I mean, of the economic problems, will depend on the coalitions to get back again and to bring stability back to the country again. If because today there were some people talking about new elections in September. If that happens, sure, the economic problems will be much less than if the elections held in February or March 2023.
Well, in terms of the EU, since you're talking about that, Paul Raffone, from what I'm understanding, the Brothers of Italy has repeatedly blamed the EU for Italy's troubles. Why do you think they're saying that or accusing the EU of that?
Well, this has been certainly a trend some years ago. But as of today, there is not this attitude towards Europe by any of the parties. There are criticisms, but criticisms are normal, I would say, in political arena. And I wouldn't see any interest by any of the parties to pull out of Europe or to say that everything which is wrong is coming from Europe. No. There will be criticisms, but this is normal because a number of things in Europe are not going in action. And it is something which is felt not only in Italy, but all over the continent. I mean, the European Union is having a lot of trouble to maintain its policy going.
Well, the European Union is grappling with a lot of different issues. And of course, the Ukraine conflict is right center of this. And Mahmoud Rafat, if you want to take a look at other countries, as our guest there said, within the European Union, they're not doing as well. So what are we looking at in terms of EU's future at this point? You know, you have Germany that is headed either to a recession or that it's just economically not pulling its strings as it should, and that's supposed to be the powerhouse. Other economies not doing as well either. Are we looking at an EU that's going to maybe go down that road of an economic crisis that it did years ago?
Well, let's say it will be economic problems. We do not expect to have real crisis yet because there will be alternative for the gas of Russia. Either there will be conciliation somehow with Russia because we know the European situation against Russia and Russian-Ukrainian war is completely influenced by the administration of President Biden in the United States. We saw President Macron at the beginning wanted to take another direction, but there was lots and huge pressures on the French president to follow the same line and to be in one policy or on one frame with others. So in my opinion, that will be somehow either conciliation with Russia at the end of the day, or that will be alternative for the gas, especially from Algeria and Qatar. There will be somehow, or they will accelerate the deal with Iran, the nuclear deal with Iran, to take gas from Iran. There will be solution. So now we do not expect but a crisis, but the problem will be deep problem still, and that impacts a lot the not only the Italian situation. I expect also there will be in other European countries, South European, I mean, especially in Greece and Spain, there will be some troubles by next winter. At the same time, that not only the German and French economy will go down, this is not the unique reason, but also because of the political equations inside these countries, the south of Europe, all the south of Europe, because of lots of reasons. Their politicians, the disagreement among their politicians, the economic situation, the immigration, the load of immigration, because this is making a heavy load on these countries, that will be somehow troubled. Well, let me say I do not wish to we have here in Europe crisis, but for sure we will pass through some economic problems.
Okay. Going through some of the headlines of how Italy is being covered, it was very interesting, Paolo Raffone, to look at one of them that doesn't appear to give a fair shake or a justice, I should say, to some political parties in Europe, where the headline reads, Italy's crisis redoubles Europeans' foreboding. Europe is being tested not only in its unified front to Russia, but in the very resilience of its democracies, as nationalist forces sympathetic to Russia remain untamed. This comes from a reputable organization, New York Times. Why do you think the New York Times would describe this in this form and manner? It's quite odd, isn't it?
Well, the fact that there is a surge of nationalism all across Europe is not new. And I have to point out that the strongest nationalism is in Eastern Europe, which is strongly anti-Russian, but is definitely very nationalist. And this you have in Poland, in Lithuania, in Romania, and so on. So this is not a new issue, and Europe is confronted with raising nationalism even in Germany. In Germany, you don't have a Germany as such. You have at least three major areas in Germany, which have each of them a different view of what Europe is or should be. And especially two out of three are signaling a stronger nationalist identity, which is not compatible with this homogeneous approach that the European Commission wants to have all over the territories of Europe. So it is a problem, certainly. And maybe it is also signaling the end of a certain way of being European Union as it has been so far. We will see. The situation is fluid at the moment, but it may change rather quickly over the next months without a leadership which is capable of reunifying the souls of the different parts of Europe.
Very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation. And thank you, Mahmoud Rafat, President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikova Tapwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jonathan N.G. Author. This article is published under the heading Covert U.S. operations in Africa are sowing the seeds of future crises. Stay tuned for more. This March, Malian forces attacked Moura, a small sun-baked town in the middle of the country. The operation began on a market day, as locals streamed into the area with their livestock. Residents recall hearing helicopters slash the air and soldiers disembark with grim resolve. Malian forces laid siege to the village for multiple days, reportedly slaughtering civilians and wreathing corpses in flames. In a clinically worded communique, the government announced
that army completed a systematic cleaning of the zone with very precise intelligence, killing 203 militants. Immediately, investigators contested its account, Human Rights Watch labeling the operation the worst atrocity in Mali's decade-long armed conflict. Estimates of civilian deaths range as high as 500. Another episode in a litany of atrocities. The United Nations has urged investigation of the latest scandal in Mali's war against militants. Yet the massacre also signifies the failure of the United States policy as Mali occupies the center of U.S. strategy in Sahel region. Since 2007, U.S. Africa Command, that is AFRICOM, has vigorously partnered with the states to combat militants, bolster influence, and check competitions there. Rather than secure peace, U.S. intervention has internationalized local conflicts, deepened social divisions, and fostered militarism. Its failure has profound roots. Malian crisis and other conflicts are inseparable from a cascading history of U.S. interventionism in Africa. African policy directly builds on the Cold War. After the Second World War, the U.S. discreetly promoted Western retrenchment in Africa. Officials helped Europeans reassert colonial mastery in order to forge a unified capitalist bloc and support for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They notably armed France during its bitter war in Algeria, which became emblematic struggle for colonialism. But as the conflict drained Western legitimacy, U.S. policymakers encouraged Europeans to substitute informal hegemony for territorial occupation. Paradoxically, a new imperial order emerged with decolonization. Western capitals maintained effective sovereignty through a balance of soft and hard power. The haze of ideology, capital markets, political pressure, military bases, and other tools that could plunge a former colony into chaos. Lacking comparable tools in Africa, the U.S. initially outsourced imperialism to European allies. Yet gradually, the U.S. cast a searing shadow back in coups to smother radicalism, open markets, and combat influence. The Democratic Republic of Congo first felt its weight in 1960. U.S. officials regarded the country as a subterranean treasure trove brimming with strategic minerals. Yet they viewed its first prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, with acute anxiety. Lumumba refused to accept Western hegemony while celebrating Congolese independence as a decisive step towards the liberation of the entire African continent. President Dwight Eisenhower wished he would fall into a river full of crocodiles. That summer, he schemed to assassinate Lumumba and install a pliant substitute. The CIA deemed his removal an urgent and prime objective. Eventually, secessionists compelled Lumumba to request UN intervention. Yet, as the historian Elizabeth Schmidt observes, the operation was largely an American affair. The U.S. ferried UN troops to the Congo while snatching power from Lumumba. After he thwarted their grasp, the CIA helped local officials apprehend him. They handed Lumumba over to secessionists, who brutally murdered him before an approving audience of Western observers. Lumumba's assassination was a cruel premonition. In following years, U.S. leaders ruthlessly eliminated exponents of African liberation. They especially targeted Kwame Nkrumah, an elegant colossus of Pan-Africanism. After Lumumba fell, Nkrumah warned that neocolonialism threatened to subvert African independence, reducing states to shells directed from outside. Nkrumah turned Ghana into a bastion of revolution, offering safe haven to anti-colonial movements and inspiring U.S. civil rights activists. In response, the U.S. State Department froze loans and depressed global prices, throttling Ghana's economy. Officers finally struck in February 1966. U.S. officials gloated that the new military government was almost pathetically pro-Western. In 1957, Ghana's liberation was the symbolic catalyst of African independence, lending decolonization an irresistible air of inevitability. By contrast, Nkrumah's downfall solidified an ominous trend toward military rule. Before 1965, coup war relatively rare. Within less than two decades, military leaders governed 40% of Africa. Ultimately, U.S. strategy curbed the promise of independence and accelerated the drift toward militarism, while carving the continent into invisible yet enduring spheres of influence. Repeatedly, U.S. partners waged catastrophic proxy wars across the region. Nkrumah's critique of neocolonialism proved prophetic. For those who practice it, it means power without responsibility, and for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. In 2020, the elaborate defense system imploded. That August, another U.S.-trained officer, Colonel Assimi Goïta, seized office in the Malian capital of Bamako, again citing the security crisis. His power grab initiated a wave of six groups in five countries within 2 years, immersing Mali, Chad, Guinea, Sudan, and Burkina Faso in chaos. AFRICOM had trained many of the plotters. In Guinea, local forces paused an exercise with U.S. Army Green Berets to storm the capital. Most coup leaders cited the threat of militants and poor governance, crises that AFRICOM had not solved but aggravated. Before 2001, U.S. officials registered no terrorist organizations in sub-Saharan Africa. By 2019, they tallied nearly 50. For years, AFRICOM had inflamed long-standing local conflicts, wrenching societies apart and lending militants meaning. And now, in a reverse domino effect, the very forces it enlisted to fight were rebelling. Tensions with Mali have compelled Western forces to scale back operations. This February, France announced troop withdrawals, while waning confidence in the West prompted local authorities to hire mercenaries. African Commander General Stephen Townsend warned that the decision would conclude in horrific violence against Africans. 2 weeks later, the Moro massacre unfolded. In the resulting fallout, Mali dissolved defense agreements with European allies this May while accusing France of espionage. The military junta then abandoned the G5 Sahel, prompting President Mohamed Bazoum of Niger to announce that the region's main security organization was dead. UN forces remain in Mali, sustaining heavy losses, investigating an exponential increase in human rights violations and defending an abrasive government that lacks control over the majority of its territory. Meanwhile, the UN warns that 18 million residents in the Sahel face severe hunger as war and famine sweep through the region. Yet the mounting crisis also implicates the U.S. AFRICOM regards itself as invisibly sleek and deadly effective, an elite force that fights tomorrow's wars today. But in practice, operations resemble previous neocolonial interventions,
fostering military rule, and human rights violations. In Truth Africa fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.